I'd like to take a break.
Sorry.
For 10 minutes.
Oh, he's the boss.
Before we go to item number 11. Okay. I think we are ready to resume. Once the rest of the board arrives, Mr. Shallcross. Mr. Briggs. One, two, three, four. We are all here, correct?
Right.
And Ms. Oaken, we don't need her.
We'll be back in a minute.
Okay. Should we start?
We shall.
Okay.
Item number 11 is our timber program update. And we have Chris Adair at the front table here, and Julia Dyer is going to be making the presentation. And also, as I pointed out many hours ago, we have a supplemental sheet and I believe three letters that were submitted. Here's Julia.
Good evening, Chairman Young, members of the board. My name is Julia Dyer. I'm an environmental scientist on staff here at the Water Board, and I'll be providing you a status report update of the activities accomplished under the Timber Harvest Program since July 2005, when this board adopted the general conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for timber harvest activities in the Central Coast region, which I'll refer to through the remainder of this presentation as the general waiver. Specifically, I'm going to speak about plans enrolled under the waiver, tracking of California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection's amendment process, standard operating procedures for continuous temperature monitoring, field inspections, and enforcements. Now, this table represents the nine plans that have been enrolled under the general waiver since the adoption of it in July 2005. These high and low and medium categories represent the ranking they received as they were evaluated through the eligibility criteria. And just as a quick reminder, the eligibility criteria is the tool staff uses to determine the most appropriate monitoring tier for each plan seeking enrollment under the general waiver. And there's three components to the eligibility criteria: cumulative effects ratio, drainage density index, soil disturbance factor. There's four possible tier rankings for a plan seeking enrollment. Those are tiers one through three, one through four, rather. Tiers one through three provide the plan under the general waiver. If the plan is evaluated through the eligibility criteria and receives a tier ranking of four, it needs to receive an individual waiver or a waste discharge requirement. And just as a quick reminder of the tiers, Tier 1 is the least stringent of the monitoring tiers, and it requires CDF, or California Department of Forestry, forest practice rules compliance monitoring, a road inventory monitoring, and forensic monitoring as necessary. Tier 2 includes the components of Tier 1 and additionally requires visual and photo monitoring. And finally, Tier 3 requires the components of Tiers 1 and 2 plus water quality monitoring for turbidity and temperature. Now, at the time that the general waiver was adopted by this board, the board directed staff to use the eligibility criteria as a backstop, meaning that as a plan is evaluated through the eligibility criteria, once it's enrolled into the general waiver, it does not receive a lower tier ranking than indicated through the eligibility criteria. And I'd like to point out that that occurred for the nine plans enrolled. Additionally, two of the plans, both Whalebone and Wilson Mathos, were promoted to Tier 3 per the request of the Water Board to collect additional water quality monitoring data. Finally, there was some discussion and concern about one of the criteria within the soil disturbance factor, and that's the mapping of skid trails. Now, per forest practice rules, a forester does not have to map their skid trails on moderate and mild terrain, so the board directed staff to use an estimated 100 feet per acre of skid trails in unmapped areas. And there was some concern that that might not be a conservative enough estimate. So eight of these plans actually mapped all of their skid trails, and through that estimation, or the mapping of the skid trails, the average acreage was 93 feet per acre. The average feet were 93 feet per acre of skid trails. So it appears that the 100 feet per acre estimation is conservative. An appropriate number. Now, the board also directed staff that the amendment process through CDF be tracked, as an amendment is a change that can be made to the timber harvest plan after it has been adopted by CDF, and the amendment can occur even after a plan has been enrolled under the general waiver. And so there is a potential that an amendment could erode the authority of the general waiver. So the board directed staff to track this amendment process, and 9 amendments were filed since July 2005 for the 7 reasons listed up here. And per the request of the board, staff would reevaluate a plan through the eligibility criteria if an amendment in conflict with the requirements, well, I shouldn't say in conflict, but something that would change its enrollment status under the general waiver. So none of these amendments merited a revision to the monitoring and reporting program, but should an amendment come through that would merit a reevaluation and a potential revision to the monitoring and reporting program, staff would take that measure. Another significant accomplishment under the timber harvest program was the development of standard operating procedures for temperature monitoring. Now, this standard operating procedures was developed and issued to all of the foresters that are required to conduct continuous temperature monitoring for their plans. And this, the full language of the standard operating procedures can be found in attachment 7 of your agenda packet. Specifically, one of the requirements within the standard operating procedures is to perform calibration checks of the data loggers used to monitor temperature. And the calibration check requires the loggers to be evaluated to ensure their functionality and the ability for them to collect viable data before they're launched in the field as a mid-season calibration check and once the data loggers are collected at the end of the monitoring season. This criteria is already proven effective as at the beginning of this current monitoring season for temperature, a forester was conducting their calibration check and found one of the data loggers to be non-functional, was able to exchange that with the manufacturer and prevent the loss of data for that monitoring point. The standard operating procedures also provide a standardized reporting format so staff can better assimilate and analyze the data for temperature, and then staff will be developing standard operating procedures for turbidity and issuing that to the foresters in September of 2006. Now, this map represents the watersheds within Santa Cruz County, and just for a little orientation, Highway 1 travels along the coast right here. Highway 17 travels north through the San Lorenzo River. Now, I've conducted 33 inspections of timberland over the past year for a total of 5,600 acres of timberland. The 9 plans enrolled under the general waiver are located in these approximate points. And I wanted to provide the board with the types of conditions I'm seeing out in the field. This is a photo of straw mulch protecting a road. This is a slash packing over a skid trail to prevent erosion. And this is a protective BMP for watercourses. You can see that the straw mulching is laid down on the road approaching and leaving this watercourse crossing right across here. And now I just wanted to point out that these aren't the photos I could find of the best examples of management practices out in the field. These photos are very much characteristic of the types of things I'm consistently seeing on my inspections.
Did you take these?
Yes, I took those photos. I also took these following 2 photos. Now, when I do see a condition in the field that might raise my concerns about the protection of water quality is when I see water running over a road or rilling on a road. And at that time when I see such a condition, I discuss with the forester what could be done to address that issue out in the field. And I also make an indication of the location in my notes so I can do follow-up and ensure that they've outsloped the road or installed additional water bars or otherwise addressed this condition. But I have not to date seen any type of condition in the field that is leading to a direct impact to water quality. These locations are leading out to a vegetated area where there's a buffer before there's any kind of water course. Now, since July 2005, 5 notices of violation have been issued for the 3 reasons I have listed here. Two are surrounding continuous temperature monitoring. Data loggers a data logger migrated from its monitoring station, and a data logger was not calibrated before it was launched into the field. This was prior to the issuance of the standard operating procedures, so data was lost for those locations. The notice of violations were filed, and for those data stations are required to collect an additional year of temperature monitoring data to make up for that. Three timber harvest operations operated without coverage under the general waiver, and this was definitely a red flag for me. So I went and inspected these sites and found that there weren't conditions out in the field that were impacting water quality directly, but NOVs were issued, and within the NOVs, they were warned that this was not appropriate, and that if the situation were to continue, that further enforcement action would be taken. So in summary, staff has not observed any specific threats to water quality. I will continue to monitor timber harvest activities throughout the Central Coast region, and I will be returning to the board in March 2007 with a preliminary analysis of the data being collected through this program for both turbidity and temperature. So that concludes my status report. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah, I think we do. I read all the material, the letters that were presented, and then your responses.
Yes.
On the way here.
Yes.
Went through them. Let's see. I think you were able to get to 5 out of 9, something like that, 5 out of 9 of the pre-harvest site inspections.
Yes, for when CDF hosted had a review team inspection, I attended 5 of the, okay. I believe 8.
Okay. And then of the balance, did you still get to the site but then met with the forester?
Yes.
Okay, so you've been to all of the sites?
Yes.
Okay. And then a lot of the criticism that I think you responded to in your, you know, memo has to do with the amount of time the foresters are feeling that it's taking staff to get on top of these applications and get the waivers issued.
Yes.
I think you alluded to some timing constraints that you had relative to when they had submitted their applications.
Yes. Would you do you want me to elaborate, or?
Well, you can. I mean, are they supposed to get them in by August 1?
That was a deadline I sent for my own planning purposes of actually August 30th. That if they want to conduct harvests that same season,
right.
I need more lead time in order to enroll them under the waiver.
How many of the 8 or 9 came in before August 30th? Do you recall?
None of them.
None of them?
Okay. I have a timeline prepared. I can show you that might give a better picture of what occurred. So this is a timeline basically since July of 2005, last year. And each of these bars represent the 9 plans that were enrolled under the general waiver and the amount of time it took in order to process them. So immediately after the waiver was adopted in August, I received one plan, Milburn. I was able to process that within a week. Then this blue shaded area right here represents the time when staff's priority was responding to the petition of the general waiver. Petition response I pulled together and was able to submit on August 16th of 2005. So during the end of September, beginning of October, I received 6 of the requests for enrollment. 2 I was able to process in advance of the wet period, or the winter period, and during this gray area represents the period of time when, except for falling of trees, harvesting is not allowed. So for these 4 plans right here, the time that it took to process the waiver was lengthened, and I prioritized my time towards conducting winter inspections, developing the standard operating procedures, and all the other information that I've provided with you. And these two plans were also submitted over the winter period, but I'd like to indicate that all of the plans were enrolled under the waiver and returned to the forester before the end of the winter period in advance of the harvesting period that started in May of 2006. So it's a constant practice of prioritization.
Did they actually fell trees during the winter, even though the waiver had not been completed in its processing? In other words, they looks like you got the applications all before November 1st, except for two of them.
Correct.
Marcellisi and Walsh.
The winter period actually begins on October 15th.
Okay. Is that October 15th? Is that
right.
Okay.
It was this Whalebone and Brooktree were the ones that actually conducted harvests before they were enrolled under the general waiver. They did that in advance of November 15th, which is the drop-dead date for being able to harvest.
Harvesting or felling?
Harvesting. All the practices associated with harvesting, not just falling. And the Mountain Residential Plan, East Fork, Marcellisi, Walsh, Fletcher, they did not conduct falling or any other type of harvest practice.
They harvested
after they applied, but before they got the permit?
Correct. Before they were enrolled under the general waiver. Excuse me, Roger.
Those were two of the notices of violation.
Correct.
That Julie mentioned on that slide about harvesting before the waiver was issued.
And who was the forester on that?
Jim Hildreth. He was the forester on both plans. He recommended to the landowners that they not conduct harvest before they were enrolled under the general waiver, but the landowners decided to proceed.
Okay.
Any reason why they decided that you know of?
I can't speak to that. I don't know.
So what's going to happen now?
They've been issued NOVs.
Okay, and so what happens? So they get a letter.
Yeah.
And then what?
That's essentially it at this point.
Well, it's
well,
too
they
late.
Had to
they
extend.
Now, right?
Huh? And they are covered under the general waiver now. They were both received coverage, Whalebone in May and Brooktree in March.
So why wouldn't anyone just go ahead and harvest before they got their waiver, because all they're going to get is a letter. It's like a big deal.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, there's something wrong there. This isn't okay.
Have we seen this forester before us before?
I don't know.
The name is not, it doesn't sound familiar to me.
I think he's been one of the commenters in the past, but
I
couldn't put a name with
it. It doesn't look like, we have the letter that's here.
He's a signatory onto that letter.
The landowner signs the letter.
I don't see his name on here. Some of the names,
let me see.
Are familiar to me. Mr. Van Lennep, do you know if he signed that letter that you signed, dated June 26th?
Chairman Young, yes, I believe that he did.
He did. Is that the second name?
The second name down in the left-hand column, yes.
James Hildreth. I might be able to offer some clarification or at least some insight as to why some of those landowners decided to proceed without a waiver and Mr. Hildreth's position in that situation.
Sure.
If the board
I'd like to hear that.
Both landowners had considerable financial status constraints that it became clear that they were not going to be able to have any active and meaningful operations on those harvest plans before the waiver was approved, and that was derived through, I believe, conversations with staff about her processing timeline. And correct me if I'm wrong, Julia, because I was not intimately involved in either of these projects. But I do know some of the background. The landowners also made decisions to operate in a limited fashion where they believed that they were not going to have any potential to impact water quality and implement all of the BMPs and implement all the forest practice rules. So there, as Ms. Dyer has alluded to, there was no impact to water quality, but the landowners also made a decision that they financially could not wait for the 6 months or so that it was going to take to get the waiver processed.
What does that mean? That someone needs to cut the trees on their property so that they can survive financially?
Yes. To not mince any words, yes, in one particular instance. Yeah.
Do they own the land just as an investment, or do they also live there?
The one that I'm more familiar with is, I wouldn't call it merely an investment. It's a calculated income source. Investment wouldn't necessarily be the right term. And also, in terms of Mr. Hildreth's involvement, he did, as far as I know, recommend to the landowners a course of action that would have held them off until they had an approved waiver. He's not in control of the situation and is only a consultant to the landowner.
Okay. Thank you. That helps.
Are these, when they make the application to you, do they have on there a date when they want to start cutting?
No.
So it's like their timber, their THP is for like a 3-year period, is it? And they can cut any time during that when it's allowed. Yeah.
Correct.
I see. So, and why again was it so long before the permits were issued on those four?
It was a balance of priorities. As the focus of my attention was responding to the petition issued against the general waiver,
right.
I had processed two of the plans, and by the time I had...
It was closed for the winter.
Correct.
They couldn't have cut anyway.
Correct. We were approaching the winter
season.
By the
time you were going to... By the time you would have got around to it.
Correct.
And then she was involved with wet weather inspections.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. And this came to light when we were talking about this. We were exploring enforcement options beyond just the notice of violation.
Okay, any other board questions? Should we go to our speakers? Our cards?
Yeah, just one additional comment I wanted to make before we heard from the speakers, and this was one of them, that we recognize this was not a good thing as far as these two proceeding. And then secondly, Julia mentioned coming back to the board in March of 07, and I was talking with Jody Fratiani at the break, and in hindsight I'm not sure why we ended up with this agenda item at this location when our next meeting is north. So apologies to you folks who had to travel, especially considering the hour of the day. So anyway, the caveat as far as the March 07, I think we should make that dependent on whether that's a north meeting or not. We don't know the schedule yet for next year, but we should adjust that depending to make it a north meeting. And then also we want to make sure that when we have a status report, you know, we're on a different timeline than we are with, say, waste discharge requirements or permit or something, and that we don't send out a draft status report for comment. So we want to make sure that we email out or otherwise mail out the status report as soon as it's available. I'm not sure we did that in this instance. So just some things I wanted to mention before the folks commented on this.
Okay. Our speakers?
Yes.
Okay.
Right there.
Thank you. Nadia Hamey, Bob Berlage, David Van Lennep, and Jody Fratiani.
Good evening, Chairman Young and members of the board. My name is Nadia Hamey, and I'm a registered professional forester for Big Creek Lumber Company. Thank you for this opportunity to come before you today to let you know how the general waiver has been functioning from our perspective. I was here last July when you adopted the waiver, and my understanding at that time was that your board wished to achieve a more streamlined process than individual waivers, where we would come before you every time. And while we have appreciated very much the efforts made by staff, by Julia, to implement the waiver, the process has turned out to be far more cumbersome than necessary and far more time-consuming than acceptable. When applying for a waiver, applicants such as myself provide a comprehensive information package to staff that should be easily verifiable with minimal time commitment from staff. This package takes some effort on my part to prepare, and it includes a detailed map, comprehensive information that's called for in the eligibility criteria to establish the monitoring tier, and the full suite of proposed monitoring points based on the tier and my intimate knowledge with the site-specific conditions on the property. At that point, we've already conceded to the monitoring and reporting called for under the tier that I will have ranked the project to fall under. And so if staff has attended the pre-harvest inspection or conducted a separate field inspection to verify the validity of those proposed monitoring points, I figure that the waiver is virtually complete at that point. Staff is spending what I consider to be an inordinate amount of time processing waivers given the level of detail provided in the application. Detailed reanalysis of all the numeric information submitted by the applicant is redundant and unnecessary. It is essentially especially unnecessary to scrutinize info in a fact sheet when winter operations are proposed on a plan, because per your direction in last July, plans that propose winter operations are automatically Tier 3, which is all monitoring, like Julia described, every temperature, turbidity, photo, forensic, everything. And staff time is thinly allocated to the timber program, as you've heard, such that any additional administrative duties or outside prioritization makes significant delays in the timely processing of waivers. And staff has acknowledged this relative to the petition, responding to the petition at the beginning of the waiver process, and also just preparing the staff report for this meeting. We're supposed to be complacent about these delays, which are completely out of our control, but it's really hard to justify, for instance, in Jim Hilder's situation, too, a landowner. We ask your board to instruct staff to streamline the review process to coincide with the THP review process and to accept waiver applications following the close of public comment with waiver approval contingent on approval of the THP. That makes perfect sense to me. These changes would hopefully improve the efficiency of waiver processing, which is our primary concern at this time. If I could just have another minute, I wish to reiterate one more time that the scope of the required data collection and reporting is an economic hardship for small forest landowners and must be proven to bear a reasonable relationship to the need for the report and the benefits to be gained from the data gathered in the field by myself per California Water Code Section 13267. And I would like also to say that unlike the agricultural waiver that we heard from before, these small forest landowners are bearing the full expense of all of the monitoring and all of my time going through the entire waiver process. And there's one other thing that I wanted to bring up. On the last slide that Julia had up, the general waiver enrollment and timeline, I have a waiver in the system right now under the general waiver that was mailed by me on February 9th, and I got a letter over a month after it had been sent by me that it was received by staff on February 14th, Valentine's Day, and it's not up there. And I have had conversations with Julia about how we won't be operating on that plan until later in July, but I'm concerned about plans where we do need to operate, because we have such a impacted timber harvest plan review process with the review agency. Sometimes that can take up to 6 months, and to stretch the review out longer. And our ability to operate once we already have an approved timber harvest plan is causing hardship. So, again, I thank you, Julia. for your efforts. I hope to continue to work with you, and thank you for your time. Are there any questions?
Any questions? Okay, thank you. Mr. Verlage. So, Julia, are there, do you have other applications right now that you're processing that don't show up on that?
Yes, there are.
Okay. And, I mean, so are you getting them through the year? Or do you receive them through the year?
Yes, yeah, they're received at any time throughout the year. They submit them to me after they've been approved by the California Department of Forestry.
Right.
So that could be at any time.
Okay. All right. How many do you have right now?
Three.
Three.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Mr. Verlage.
Thank you, Chairman Young and members of the board. Nadia Hamey eloquently said many of the things I have in my notes. So I'd like to talk about one of the interesting things, sort of insightful, was interesting to see the discussion and report on the ag waiver. So I think what I'd like to talk about is an issue that we've brought up many times in the past, and that's the request that our activity receive a regulatory process and a monitoring protocol that's commensurate with the scope of our land use. And in, for example, in the ag waiver, you've got roughly 500,000 acres of bared mineral earth, and if I understood the report correctly, you have 50 permanent monitoring stations. You know, we have projects that are 20, 30 acres that may have 10 monitoring stations on them alone in a watershed where our activity, it's possible, is the only land use activity that has monitoring. We've also heard that elsewhere in the state, the time frame for getting permission basically from other water boards after applications have been filed is running anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks. And although I've covered this ground in the past, I want to remind your board that the scope of the timber harvesting activities in those other areas dwarfs what we do down here in the Central Coast. The silviculture logging practices are different, and they're not as restrictive. And yet those people, and then I'd venture a guess that the monitoring stations per acre on those other regions' timber activities are far fewer than the per acre monitoring roughly that we're required to do. And you know, there's an element of inequity there in that. I understand that regions are different, but when you got a small landowner, and I can't speak to the notice of violations, or we weren't involved with those projects that Mr. Hildreth was involved with, but inherently can understand the immense frustration when we've got a CEQA-compliant process and we have to go through that entire process, and your staff is involved with that process and, in fact, has been instructed by this board on a number of occasions to participate in that process, the THP process. And we start back at square one once we submit an application. So I'm out of time, but I simply would like to reiterate the recommendation that you instruct staff to accept applications at the point in time of close of public comment in the CDF process. And under CEQA, there can be no substantive changes after that time. If there is a problem, staff and the board you have the ability to put a stop on our project. You have complete control over what we do, and you can put up the brakes and stop and consider the things that you're concerned about. This would be no extra workload for staff. All we're asking is that they simply do those responsibilities, review the plan, which they can do if they attend the pre-harvest inspection, look at all those relevant points that are going to be indicated when we submit the application, photo point monitoring, where the crossings are, and so forth, and start some of that work earlier in the process. So we're not looking at 140-day periods after we've got a state-approved permit and only 120 working days in a year to carry out our process. And appreciate giving me the extra 30 seconds to get that off my chest, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, did the two of you review Julia's comments that she submitted as supplemental?
It was our reading material on the drive down here.
Okay. Because, you know, I read through them on the drive up here. And, you know, my sense is that she has a handle on things, that there's been some reasons for the delay in getting to all nine or all eight in a more timely fashion, and that the need for her independent review appears to me to be justified if she's finding discrepancies and or missing information.
See, that may be, we don't know the substance of that. We don't know whether that the missing missing information it has any impact on the project relative to water quality. I personally don't know what it is the discrepancies that she's finding and how substantive those are. But let's assume for the sake of argument that she finds discrepancies. She's going to find those discrepancies if she starts the process earlier in the time frame we're talking about, because you can't make substantive changes in the harvest plan through CDF's process after the public comment is closed, because if you do, you've violated CEQA. So it's just a suggestion that there I believe there's a mechanism in there with staff fully engaging in the timber harvest review process, that there's stuff that staff's going to need, Julia's going to need, in order to assess our applications that can be done during that review process. And it's transparent. We're going to conduct a timber harvest.
Okay. Let me ask her a couple questions, if I may interrupt you. When you receive their application, I take it, is that at some point in advance of the pre-harvest site inspection?
excuse me. No, per conditions of the order, they issue me the application after the harvest plan has been adopted by CDF.
After?
After.
What? How length of a time after?
They usually submit it to me the same day.
From CDF?
The same day that the plan is approved by CDF, the forester issues me the application with the proof that it's been approved by CDF.
And this is after the pre-harvest
Correct.
Site inspection?
Correct.
So you're notified of the pre-harvest site inspection before you even get the application?
Correct.
How long is it between the close of comment and the issue of the THP by CDF?
I don't know the answer to that.
One what?
Well, I can answer that.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. I thought you were saying one.
Thank you. David Van Lennep, registered professional forester. The standard time allotment is 10 days between close of comment period, close of public comment period, and director's decision. That's the minimum statutory length of time. Often we have to extend that time period out so CDF can make additional analysis, but 10 days is the minimum. So that would, in effect, give us an extra 10 days in the process, and there can't be any substantive changes in the plan, or CDF has to reopen the plan for public comment, and that has happened also.
Yeah, and so how would this work? Do you need the timber harvest plan in order to fill out the application for our waiver, right?
We have all the information.
That's what I mean. You need the information from the plan.
The comprehensive information that we send to staff to begin the waiver application process is either in the timber harvest plan as submitted, or is derived from information in the harvest plan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could
we could probably, in a, we could essentially put all that information together and send it to staff concurrent with submission to CDF. I don't believe that that's necessarily the way staff would like to have that run, but we have that information on tap as soon as we have the harvest plan ready for submission to Department of Forestry.
Okay. Thanks.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure. David, typically, though, when you put your plan into CDF, that plan changes over time as you go through up to the comment period.
Correct. There can be, in some cases, substantive modifications of the plan from submission once it's accepted for filing, and then after the review process, the pre-harvest inspection, there can be substantive changes. And that's one of the reasons we fell back to the close of comment period. We were aware that staff didn't want to put time into processing waiver application that may be substantially different. But after the close of comment period, then those changes, any substantive changes other than essentially wordsmithing things are not allowed to be done without reopening that comment period.
Why don't you go ahead with your comments?
Since I'm here?
Yeah, since you're here. Unless we've already heard them.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young and members of the board. I wanted to touch on one of the items that we had expressed concern about and that staff had responded to, which was the late season submissions. I understand that Julia had submitted the August 31st date as just a timekeeping and not necessarily a hard and fast date, but I wanted to explain some of the reasons that we are concerned about not having the ability to get a waiver in a timely fashion at the end of the season particularly. Harvests can be operated either in entirety or in parts from beginning late in the season and then finishing up prior to any onset of actual wet weather. We frequently need that extra time period after the mandated October 15th date of beginning of winter period, which has nothing to do with wet weather onset, to finish up some of these operations, and it allows people to get some financial return off of their harvest after paying for a likely $25,000 timber harvest permit without having to wait a whole another 6 or 8 months to have something happen. So those are very important issues for small landowners particularly. Those operations can be operated, again, either in part or in entirety without any additional threat to water quality as long as all the conditions of the harvest plan and the waiver are adhered to. One of the other issues that we have is with the somewhat punitive measures that are included in the waiver for proposing of winter operations, and that includes timber falling and any of these other things. As soon as we propose winter operations, that automatically bumps a harvest plan up to Tier 3. And what we'd like to request the board do is allow the applicant to submit a letter to the board opting back down to the tier that is appropriate for the plan and not the artificially elevated tier due to winter ops. For example, if staff determines a harvest plan as a Tier 2 harvest plan, they propose winter operations, but those winter operations are never enforced, then that plan would drop back down from Tier 3 to a Tier 2 if those operations were completed before the winter period began. That would alleviate some of the pressure that's come to bear merely as landowners are trying to take advantage of some of that extended winter period. And if the board would direct staff to make some mechanism for that to happen, that would be very useful. Also, reiteration of two previous points to allow staff to receive applications prior to the approval of the THP, more specifically after the close of comment period, and then the waiver would be pending. Waiver approval would be pending timber harvest plan approval. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any more questions about this or any of the NOVs.
Yeah, you sort of lost me on the winter harvest gets an automatic jump up in tier. Could you explain the situation again that you're talking about? Where a person could go down to the tier they would be at if they didn't do a winter harvest.
Sure, you're familiar that the waiver automatically mandates, okay, an upgrading. So what we're proposing is that since the harvest plan could be approved through the CDF process, say in April of an operating year, it may be entirely feasible to get that harvest done well before the October or November 15th onset of winter period by, as per the forest practice rules. What we're requesting is that if that is in fact the case, that the waiver is approved with, say, the Tier 3 monitoring requirements. If that harvest is actually completed before the onset of winter period, the hard and fast date of winter period, then we would have some mechanism to send in a letter as a landowner or RPF or discharger to inform staff that we have in fact completed all active operations, the harvest has been, you know, winterized and is essentially active operations are done, and allow that monitoring program to be not reduced but put back to where it tiers out, if you will, through the matrix.
And then if you did go into winter harvesting at another year,
then
it could be ramped back up.
Correct. We would have to apply to get back down, so the onus would be on us or the landowner, and it would be an incentive to try and get those things done. Not that we don't have incentive to do that already, but there's other limitations that don't allow that, and that would be something that would be useful for us if the board saw fit.
So as it stands now, if you apply for a winter operation, and but you start before winter, let's say. Are you doing let's say you're at a Tier 2, but because of the winter application, you're popped up to Tier 3. Are you doing Tier 3 monitoring even before winter?
No. Well, the monitoring that we end up doing, well, I guess it would depend. It would be we would have to install our HoboTemp devices as soon as timber operations were active.
Even if it was before winter.
Correct. Let's say for the sake of argument, the harvest plan began in, say, June. We would have to put the hobo temps in prior to onset of active operations. And I think the landowner would be willing to have to do that. If there was a temperature monitoring requirement, I think they would be willing to have that single season of temperature monitoring go on while they had an option to opt out of it for, say, the next 2 to 5 years under the Tier 3.
So
they would embark on the single season of turbidity or temperature monitoring as per the Tier 3 waiver. And if they got that harvest complete, then they would be able to submit a letter to staff saying, we got done prior to October 15th, the plan is complete, we're finished, we would like to have our tier two coverage under the waiver.
Well, then, under the plan, legally, does the staff have the flexibility to do that?
I have to look and see the way the waiver is drafted, if it's a term of the waiver as opposed to a term of the monitoring plan. But it seems to me that the harvester might be able to just amend the application or submit a new application, but it sounds pretty doable. I just have to look at it. It may require some board action.
It's condition 25 of the order on page 5, which is...
Yeah, I'll have to look at it later.
You'll have to look at it later?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that sounds
reasonable. But, I mean, we're basically talking about monitoring requirements,
yes,
which is generally something that's done at a staff level.
Right. Okay.
You might be able to assume that if we were able to review the temperature data from that one period of time and we agreed that there wasn't a problem, then, I mean, we could either say yes or no if there was a request from a forester, I suppose. In other words, we could say no if the temperature monitoring indicated that they really should be monitoring temperature. Follow?
What kind of data would that look like?
high temperatures.
Aside from the logistics of how we would go about it, do you see any downside of pursuing this change?
No, I don't, because the eligibility criteria would have ranked it as a Tier 2.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're artificially lowering it.
Right.
So what you're saying, Julia, it's ranked a number 2 when you look at it, and
correct,
the only reason because it's going to a 3 is simply because it creeps into the winter process.
Or they're saying they might go.
Correct.
Might.
Proposed winter offers.
Yeah, proposed. Yeah.
Well, we've already encountered this with one of the other plans. It was actually, that the Marsalisi plan, it ranked as Tier 1, but they had proposed winter operations. So I called the forester and told them that they're ranked as Tier 1, but they're going to need to do Tier 3 monitoring because of the winter operations. So they filed an amendment with CDF and, so they would no longer retain the option to harvest during the winter. And that kept them at Tier 1.
Okay, well,
so we need to look into the logistics of it.
We'd be happy to work with staff on some of the particulars. We're just requesting that staff be directed to at least explore the option and maybe create a mechanism that we can do that.
Well, I think that can be done. We can have staff look at it.
Also, the streamlining and the timing, too, if that's a possibility, if there's some way to handle that.
I'm sorry.
Streamlining the timing of processing the application. If there's a way to shorten the time, if you can look at CDS, if they've closed the comment period, can you start activating the permit through us at that time? And if there's any changes, you can always stop it. How long does it take you to process the permit?
It takes me about 2.5 days to process a permit in total. of working on it exclusively.
Yeah. And are you part-time on the timber harvest?
Yes.
Because that's all we have, right? A 0.5 person?
Correct. 0.06 PY.
0.6 or point? You said 0.06.
That would be 0.06.
0.6, excuse me, yes.
Yeah.
That would be even less.
Yes.
Yeah.
Considerable.
I don't know.
What? And, Julia, how do you spend, what's your 0.4? Time comprised of what other projects or programs?
It's in the non-point source program, managing contracts related to agriculture.
And do they have any time constraints?
Yeah, they have time constraints because they're submitting their invoices and wanting to get their money paid and that type of thing.
Okay. Well, now, certainly, whatever you're able to do to streamline this, I mean, you budget your time, and whatever can be done to get these processed, sooner than later, I think would be helpful. Perhaps what you've had to deal with in the last year has revolved around handling the petition, responding to it.
Yeah, that was part of it.
Eaten up some of your time.
Absolutely.
Maybe when we look at this in another 6 months or so. Things will be better in terms of processing time, but
correct. And it also has a lot to do with how many enrollment requests I've received. One moment. Because as I pointed out, is at the time that those four were actually extended over the winter period, I'd had 6 requests for enrollment under the waiver. So again, it's a constant balancing of time, and as Nadia pointed out, the one submitted in February, she told me that it could wait until July, so I took that, and it's just a constant rebalancing of priorities. So it's the conditions just aren't always going to be the same.
All right.
It is very fragile, and although Julia is diligent in her 0.6 PY, it's clear that even something like the responding to the petition can really turn the apple cart over and really delay things. And unfortunately, that's damaging to us, and we've We've worked with Julie, and she's been very forthright about her time allocation and her ability to process, but the delays are damaging. Okay. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your comments. Jody Fradiani.
Okay, so thank you, Chairman Young and members of the board. I'm Jody Frediani, and I'm representing today the Sierra Club, Ventana and Loma Prieta chapters. I want to start by saying that we concur with the many excellent points that were in the comment letter recently submitted by Kevin Collins. And secondly, we're pleased to see that staff recognized key issues in our petition as critical points that must be addressed to improve regulation of timber harvesting, such things as file management and SOPs. And because of the brief amount of time I have right now, I'm going to keep my comments to basically three continuing concerns of ours, some of which you've already heard about in a different aspect. Point 6PY is just insufficient time for staff not only to develop and administer the timber waiver program, but to fully participate in the CEQA THP review process. Staff has participated in most but not all of the PHIs, as indicated, and going out with a forester separately doesn't really accomplish the same thing. It's not part of a team process. Staff rarely submits written comments with proposed mitigations, as is done by the other reviewing agencies, and staff never participates in second review as part of the review team. And that's where the decisions are made and the final mitigations are incorporated, put place to protect water quality. What we think, you know, in spite of that, staff has been hosting industry roundtables and, you know, organizing a big water board tour. And we think that the priorities need to be re-reviewed and that more time needs to be allocated. The second issue has to do with sedimentation and also the issue of TMDLs. We don't think sedimentation is being taken seriously or actually monitored properly. That sometimes the wrong choice of tools and improper use of them is taking place. Turbidity signals are being obscured by upstream inputs and leading to useless data. In such cases, other tools like erosion pins should be employed, and we would suggest additional staff education, either with experts or working with the North Coast Water Board staff, an expansion of the monitoring tool choice that can be used, and a more intelligent application of those tools that are available. We were talking about threatened endangered fish, largely 303 delisted water bodies, and drinking water supplies at stake here. And the last thing I want to talk about has to do with the process. We're asking, once again, for a transparent process and equal treatment and opportunity for all the stakeholders. Now, in the ag process, you had a very comprehensive stakeholder process from the get-go. That didn't happen here with the timber waivers. And what's happened this year, there was a we weren't invited to participate in the industry roundtable that was led by our staff. Some industry members were allowed to attend the full day-long water board tour. We weren't even noticed that it was happening. We heard about it from CDF. The listserv is not being used to communicate with all the stakeholders, and while the industry had advanced notice of this meeting, even though we submitted a petition, which of course has created a hardship, but it's what this report is responding to, I got my first notification from staff about this meeting a week ago when I received the packet. And that doesn't seem to be really appropriate or necessary. And the third thing is, and this came to your board before, I send emails to staff, you know, with a question, and the next thing I know is that my email is being forwarded to members of the timber industry, and yet their emails never get forwarded to me. And I think that's really inappropriate, and I would like to see a change. Feel that the Water Board mandate is to protect the public trust resource, to serve all the stakeholders, and not simply to be serving the regulated industry. And just as another small thing, I'm not sure I heard that there was a supplemental report by staff. Was there such a thing?
We just got it a day or two ago.
Okay, because it's not in the...
But those always come.
It's not. It's not in the in the... Where is it? Okay. It's not in with item 11, so if it's someplace else I missed it, I apologize, but I couldn't find it.
Is it on the web? When you guys generate these, do you immediately put them on the web?
Wasn't this just last Wednesday?
Correct. And I did email it to Jody the same time the board received it.
You emailed me the supplemental?
Yes.
She?
Yes.
When?
Wednesday evening.
Did you email it to Jody or Kevin?
Oh, to Kevin. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry?
Yes, I emailed it to Kevin. Yeah. I spoke incorrectly.
But you, so yes. You emailed it only to the people who submitted comments?
Correct.
Okay. Well, that's fine, but I couldn't find it in the... Yeah. I mean, that was one of the first things I looked for when I came in today was a response to the letters that were there, and I just couldn't find it. So maybe it's there, it's misplaced, or maybe it's not there. But that's a small point. I would really encourage you to direct staff again. I feel like the issue of transparency, I'm going to have talked to Julie about some of these things. It seems that there's a glass, one of those one-way glasses, and the other side needs to be, you know, cleared off so that it just is. It makes me very uncomfortable to realize that I can't communicate with staff via email without having my communications immediately forward to industry. And basically what that does is it limits my ability to communicate, and I don't have that problem with the other agencies, including CDF, and yet I feel uncomfortable with the communication process here.
Julia, is that something that you did with one of Ms. Fradiani's letters or emails?
Yes.
Okay. We had something like this happen with Mr. Arkfeld. I don't know if you're aware of that.
No.
Okay. And
what's that?
Didn't Bill do something like that? It's not a good practice. And perhaps what we can do, and this might help with the transparency thing, is that perhaps, and tell me, you know, if we get letters in, can't all the stuff be scanned and just kind of loaded onto a spot on our website where we're dealing with, you know, ongoing timber issues? And then even the emails that come in, they could be saved as a PDF and then also posted.
Yeah, they could. And I'm not sure what email everyone's talking about. If it was a question about a plan, then it may be that the forester needed to answer the question. But also, right, if it was a comment on something that was under review for approval or non-approval, the person submitting the application has a right to see it.
The email was about a specific plan and about some management practices within that specific plan. So I did CC David on that because I wanted him to be able to respond to how he'd be addressing the concern.
I think the better practice would be to email Ms. Fradiani and say, I'm going to be forwarding your email to so-and-so for comment.
Okay.
And then she can say, or... Okay.
Well, once we get anything, it's public.
Right. That was the understanding I had.
That's right.
Yeah. Anything we get belongs to the public.
Okay.
Emails, then she should. Phone messages.
Then she should at least notify her.
Yeah. But I think that.
Or copy her on the email.
Well, copy her on it. Yeah.
I think this should be the understanding that we operate under with everything. That anytime someone communicates with us, that is to be shared, you know, with any other member of the public.
Well, what I would say is it's hard for me to imagine, and maybe industry has just chosen not to use the email, medium for that reason, but it's hard for me to imagine that there's nothing that they've ever submitted that was not relevant to something that I might be concerned about. And so it's the only thing that I've ever seen are that my emails get forwarded. And in terms of a question, another way that I could see with dealing with that is if there was a question, and in this case I didn't think it was a question that necessarily needed to go to the forester. It was a question about how staff intended to handle something. And it seems to me that another way to do that is to say, you know, if she wants to say to the forester, well, I've had a question about, you know, thus and such, and this is what I'm intending to do about it, instead of actually passing on my email with my email address and things like that. I just,
you know, if you'd sent a letter that had your address on it, you know, like your letterhead with your phone number, it's
out there. So I guess... I'm really clear when I send emails about how I send it. In this case, you know, I chose to send it directly to Julia, not to CC it on up to Roger, because
right.
I thought, because to me, when I start out with something like that and I send it up to management, it feels like I'm asking management to look over this person's shoulder and that maybe I'm not trusting the staff person. And in this case, it was just a question. It was a dialogue.
Right.
And so clearly, you know, if I want to have those dialogues, I'll just pick up the telephone and attempt to do that. But I know that your board gave direction. Julia wasn't here at the time, mm-hmm. but, you know, the rest of your staff was that this kind of one-way window is not, you know, is not really appropriate. And it's just, you know, as I said, I feel like I can communicate with staff people in other agencies with questions, with specific issues. It's not a matter of, you know, whether it's CDF or any other agency. And if they're sending these things on, they're sending them without letting me know. But I feel like I just, you know, it's just a dialogue. And I understand that maybe, you know, maybe with an email, it takes on a different status because it's written. But at the same time, I also understand that there are the electronic, you know, privacy acts that, you know, one can excerpt something and not send email addresses. I mean, there's just different ways of handling it.
I'm just trying to get a handle on what we can do generally with communication and the sharing of information. And so that there's a timely exchange of all the people that are interested in, you know, the timber issue. You know, the people that have been participating over the last 3 years or so, we all know who they are. And I think that there should be a mechanism to quickly do this. I mean, your staff, your time is limited, no question about it. I'm just thinking perhaps it might be very worthwhile to digitize all documents that come in.
Mr. Chair, why don't we instruct staff to look at different options, how we can accomplish this. And as far as emails, any document that comes into this agency is a public document, so... You know, if you don't want your name on anything, then...
Well, I also understand that they're public documents, not every document that I send gets forwarded directly to somebody else.
I understand.
And that's
that.
A very big difference.
But I just make a side comment that every document we receive is a public document. And I'm asking the staff, then, to come back with options and how do we make this transparent, not only your direction, but also the other direction.
Right. So may I ask a question about that, then, if they're all public? Is there some place that I can come in to this office and ask to see all the email exchanges that have taken place? I mean, are they in a file someplace that actually...
Mm-hmm. You can make a request.
Yeah, you can make a Public Records Act request. They're not all necessarily printed and put in the file. More significant emails are printed for the file. You can request emails that are available electronically, and we have a records retention policy, so any emails that still exist in our system, we can forward.
Right. I mean, that's very different. I know with our county, you know, if you send a letter, the letter gets posted in a certain place, and it may go on the web, I'm not sure. And if somebody wants to check these things out, they can find them, and that's a known process. But, you know, there's a difference between a Public Records Act request for something, which also is a huge time lag before it's, you know, fulfilled, and an email immediately getting forwarded to, you know, to somebody else. So
I think we understand the issue.
Yeah.
I think we'll have the staff research and come back with different options that
okay.
we
could.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just want to point out, just for on a regular day-to-day doing business, I've done what we're talking about here probably 10 million times in my working here. I forward emails to other parties on a regular basis or respond to parties and CC all those involved. So I think what you were talking about earlier about just CCing the parties is the answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple.
Yeah.
It's straightforward. Unless someone says this is confidential or they have some reason for not doing it.
And maybe that's what Ms. Fradiani should do is to, I guess, put on her email and not to be forwarded.
You can't do that.
You can't say it's confidential?
It's illegal, yeah. It violates the Public Records Act.
Yeah.
So out of courtesy, I think if we're going to, instead of just forwarding something from an author and not letting that person know, we should just CC that person if we're forwarding, yep, or if we're responding to all. Make sure they are copied as well.
Right.
Well, in this specific instance, Jody had sent me an email requesting some information about how I was going to proceed about a specific issue on a timber harvest plan. So I replied to Jody and I CC'd David Van Lennep because he was the forester associated with that plan. So just from the direction I've received, I felt like I was doing the transparency.
So you were notified at the time that she forwarded your email.
Yeah, that's how Jody's aware that I
got the CC. I mean, she responded to me and it was CC. The response was CC'd to the forester. So I did that.
All right. Thank you.
If I could just make a comment here, because I appreciate the time you're putting into this issue. It's actually probably one of the smaller ones, because it's also one that I can deal with in different ways as well, if I'm concerned about it. But I hope that you give some attention to the other concerns that I brought up. And, you know, in this case, where there was a field trip that was put together for other water boards, and I understand that, you know, some of the timber industry folks were presenting at it, but I also understand that some of them were able to participate in other portions of the tour that they weren't participating in, they weren't presenting in, and yet I learned about this event from CDF, I learned about it from the county, I didn't hear from, you know, water board staff that this was happening and wasn't invited to participate.
What was this?
Region 3 hosted the Timber Roundtable for the other regions to come here and have. We have roundtable discussions every several months, and this was a site visit to Santa Cruz County.
But was it what was the thrust of the visit? I mean, what were the topics of discussion?
It was for the other regional board staff members to see examples of timber harvest practices on within the Central Coast. So it was a succession of visits to timber harvest plans.
I see.
The different, I don't know which tour you're talking about, but the different programs have roundtables, various intervals, and sometimes the regions host those. And, you know, for example, an enforcement roundtable, an underground tank roundtable, and the program managers from each region would typically attend, and sometimes they have site visits that are associated with that.
So was this something where industry representatives went on a tour, or that there had to be a landowner there to do a site visit?
The landowner or the registered professional forester was there for a site visit. We had to secure permission from each of the landowners to go on their property.
But they also went to a site on a county road that was not a site that they were presenting at, so they were actually there to hear the presentation that was being made.
Well, so what?
Pardon
so
me?
What?
So what? So
it's not
I would like
the law.
I would like equal opportunity. I mean, if there's information that's being presented and discussed, and the regulated industry is getting an opportunity to participate, I'd like to participate too. That's all. I mean, it's you know, it's an educational opportunity. It's an opportunity to understand what the dialogue is. I mean, it's a process, and as you know, we saw with the ag waiver business, there was a very extensive stakeholder process, and what's happening here is there's not that kind of process, and there's information that's being exchanged, and the other stakeholders, and we are stakeholders in this process, are cut out of a lot of the I shouldn't say a lot, but we're cut out of portions of the process. And I'm just asking that, you know, if it's a staff meeting, you know, and they're making a presentation here and, you know, that's what they do, that's fine. But if it's an opportunity, if it's a site visit and, you know, some stakeholders are being allowed to participate in the whole thing, then I think it's only fair and reasonable, since you are a state agency and you represent, you know, the public, that all interested parties be invited and allowed to participate on equal footing.
Okay, well, maybe staff can include that.
Your concern is noted.
Notice in the opportunity to participate, you know, when, you know, various issues take place or meetings.
Well, this is a staff-level meeting, essentially,
yeah.
With,
correct.
With a site visit.
Yes.
I would understand if the board was involved in it and we make it a public notice.
Right,
and
there's
type
a difference
of thing.
There. Yeah.
But this is a staff participation. You have to get approval. You have to have somebody go with you on that particular piece of property. It's
correct.
It's not a public, per se, outing or demonstration. It's a staff level. Now, if a board was going, board members were going, yeah, then we would notice it. And then the public would be entitled to come.
I understand that. And when I first actually heard about this, I assumed that it was simply a staff meeting and didn't think any more about it. But then later on, I talked to certain agency and several agency people who participated, and I simply learned that some of the foresters were allowed to go on the whole visit as if they were, you know, attendees and not simply presenting. And I don't have a problem with them doing that. I just think that if they're being allowed to do that, that it's fair access that other, and it's not like we're talking about a whole fleet of, you know, folks showing up, but that the rest of us who have been actively involved in this process be given an opportunity to participate.
We will make a greater effort to include all stakeholders.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have any more cards, Mr. Chairman?
No more cards.
Okay.
I think.
So we will. We have a number of follow-up things to check on and report back to you about the outcome of those.
And when do we get our report back?
I think these are pretty short-term items, so I would think by the next meeting.
Okay. So they'll be in the EO report?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sound reasonable?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you very much. We can now move on to